It's Friday, April 22nd, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, after Spot of Geek News, we're speaking with home solar expert Andy Black all about making your home use solar energy. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The phone number 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Drew Meyer, storage specialist at AdaptTech, and Sean Cleveland, senior PR marketing manager for NetCell. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Morning, Lyle.
Good morning, Lyle.
Before we get into our discussion with Andy Black about solar energy and how you get your home prepared, let's do some geek news. Sean.
This week was kind of a big week for tech. It was the National Association of Broadcasters Convention in Las Vegas, NAB. I had the opportunity to go out there and spend the day on the show floor Monday, and it was quite a big show. I was in meetings, so I didn't get a chance to stop at all the booths I wanted to. I was literally running from one hall to another all day. But I think the coolest technology, the new Las Vegas tram going to the convention center. Actually, it's
from
pretty
the
nice. No, it comes from the Strip.
Uh-huh.
It's very deceiving. You're standing on the Strip, and you see a big sign that says Las Vegas tram, you know, just go through a door. And then you find yourself in a casino, and you have to walk. There's no clear path. You have to wind your way through a casino.
Imagine that.
Through the back of the hotel,
I'm
down a long walkway, and you get to the tram. Like, ugh. They make you, I mean, anything you do, you have to walk through a casino.
Okay, so.
The price of a tramway is exposure to the casino.
Yeah, pretty much.
What about the tech on the floor in the NAB?
The tech on the floor is pretty interesting. I was really blown away by HD cameras, which are reaching like $3,000 price ranges now. And, HDV,
did
HD
you pick
video.
One up?
I did actually. A guy had one on the floor. It was the new Sony with the Easy Cam. It was on a pole actually, mm-hmm. And I held it and moved it around, and the whole thing weighed maybe just a couple pounds. It was nothing, and it looked beautiful. And there's a lot of codecs. At the AMD booth, they were showing one off. You know, I'll have to get some details and maybe write something up. I did take a bunch of pictures, but it was really neat what they could do with MPEG-4 technology now. They can take MPEG-2 and compress it down to MPEG-4. It actually looks better streaming over the, broadband connection. I was really impressed with a lot of just that sort of thing. It's broadcasting. And I did stop by the HD radio booth, and I saw the NPR car. I forget what kind of car it was. But, it was pretty neat to see what they were doing. Like I said, I have pictures. We'll try and get them up on the GeekSpeak site. But from the show, Intel announced dual-core processors. Everyone's been talking about it for a while, and they finally released them. They're the first ones to do it. They beat AMD by, 4 days. Their chips are going to be in Alienware, Dell, and Velocity Micro machines. They announced the Pentium Extreme Edition 840, which is running at about 3.2 gigahertz, and uses Intel's 955X chipset.
And that's a dual core machine?
Yeah.
Dual processor or just two core?
Dual core.
Okay.
So
one
dual core processor. One processor with two cores. Exactly.
Yeah, correct.
And that in $1,000 unit quantities, it's about $1,000. So
that's expensive.
More than that for retail.
Mm-hmm.
That's hitting the consumer space. Intel is targeting the consumer space.
That's an expensive processor, though.
AMD is targeting workstation servers, mm-hmm. mostly servers, with their dual core, which is the X2 brand. It's a dual-core Opteron, which is their 64-bit chip. Very high-end. So many models, I don't even want to get into it.
Okay.
But they have an Athlon 64X2 line. They have an 800 series for 4-way and 8-way, and a lot more. So it's kind of crazy. You know, I got sent an email off to AMD, And I'd like to get someone on the air.
Yeah, talk about their course.
See what we can do, yeah.
Sean, I'm going to flip over to Andrew now. Or Drew, please, you're next.
Okay, well, along the lines of walking through the casino to get to your tram ride for free, it looks like advertising...
Oh, it's not free.
The tram is not free?
It was free during the beta phase, but now, yeah, it's like $3 a ride.
So you actually get to pay for the privilege of walking through the casino.
It's better than a taxi cab. It's air-conditioned.
You're right. I'll quit whining about it. Along those lines, this story fits right in. Advertising in video games is worth $1 billion by 2010. Isn't that amazing? So you're sitting there playing. You pay money to play the video game, and you're actually paying money to get spammed by advertisers running in the background of the video game.
And is that market already running?
It started. Yeah. This is a survey from the Game Initiative, and they're looking at the market of in-game advertising growing about 760% over the next 5 years.
So right. As you're walking through the virtual jungles of Vietnam, you might hit a Coke display.
Right. You'll trip over a Coke can, right? Whoa, where'd that come from?
You have to use the Coke machine.
That's just amazing. You have to pay to get advertised to. It looks like in Paris, North Carolina. I never even heard of Paris, North Carolina. They're having a ghost concert where they have two piano virtuosis that are both dead. Their music has been programmed into two specially note-perfect computer-controlled pianos. Ancient recordings made by Alfred Cortot in 1928 and Glenn Gould in 1962 will be replicated. Every note will be struck down to the velocity of the hammer and the position of the key when it was played. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
So you can attend the concert, there'll be nobody there, and the music will be exactly like when the guy recorded it. Huh. That's pretty geeky.
That is pretty geeky.
Oh, my God.
Or the pianos will be the same.
One more here. Some mice that have been put in suspended animation. This is new technology, new cutting-edge
frontier. Just computer mice or real mice?
No, these are real white mice type, running around furry mice.
Now you really sure they're white?
I know, I'm not. Maybe okay, I'm being a mice racist there, I don't know. The mice have been placed in a state of near suspended animation, raising the possibility that hibernation could one day be induced in humans.
Right. Now, this thing, basically, they've got them get down their temperature almost to freezing for, like, hours on end, and they breathe, multiple times per minute. Now they're breathing, like, three times a minute, and afterwards, they bring the temperature back up, and they're fine.
As far as they say, huh?
As far as they say. They're not doing calculus now, right. Which is strange. So.
It says here that this is the concept phase for putting astronauts into hibernation-like states for long-haul space flights. And that's right out of science fiction.
They wake the mouse up in 200 years, and he goes, I'm hungry.
Yeah.
Right. To it, nothing has changed.
I'm cold. Geek news. All right. Give us another one, Sean.
Yeah. So from Las Vegas, a company called Enphase has promised a 300-gigabyte holographic drive by 2006. This thing holds about 50% more data than current hard drives. They expect a 300-gigabyte version. By 2006. And then by 2009, the company expects capacity to increase to 1.6 terabytes.
Okay. Well, there's some numbers I can understand. I mean, 300-gigabyte drive.
Yeah, I'm expecting drive manufacturers to be there anyway.
Yeah.
But data transfer rates are only about 27 megabytes per second, which is like of what drives are now. So.
That's,
but interesting technology anyway. Maybe by then they'll have the speeds up.
Mm-hmm.
And U.S. consumers bought more than 400 million DVDs in the first quarter.
400 million DVDs?
Yeah.
There's 300 million people in the country? Wait a minute. So the productivity's down, the economy's in the tank.
So sales jumped about 21% from 332 million units in the first quarter of last year to 403 million this year. Quite a jump. And DVD player sales of 7.5 million during the first 3 months of the year brought the total up to 135 million. God, 135 million DVD players sold already. So, I don't know. Interesting.
It is interesting.
Wow.
So, let's see. Adobe to acquire Macromedia in $3.5 billion deal. Now, this is impressive to me. The two giants. I mean, undisputed. You want to talk about monopolies almost.
Yeah, that was the buzz on the floor.
Yeah, I bet. Especially for NAB, exactly.
Yeah.
If you're going to broadcast, if you're going to do any kind of digital creation, these are two companies you're familiar with, you're paying already, you're licensing software from, and they have very little competition.
Yeah, it's really nice because now they'll have less competition, so they won't have any reason to innovate and such. it kind of upsets me, the idea that these two companies are merging. Though the software that both of them produce,
they do
good.
A good job, right?
Yeah,
and their marketing has been strong enough that people don't have negative reactions to it.
Yeah, yeah.
I just hope Dreamweaver doesn't go away.
Right?
Nah, Go Live will go away. Adobe Go Live's dead, I'm sure, and Dreamweaver will keep going.
Adobe Flash,
kind of weird. Adobe Flash, right?
Yeah,
what's up
weird.
With that?
Very strange.
Anyway,
it's actually kind of a shame. Adobe has a whole push for SVG, an open source format for vector graphics online and scripting vector graphics, kind of like the Flash engine does. And I could see that Adobe would stop pushing that. Drew?
I guess it would make sense, but I like that story. It seems interesting. Let's see. Adware market booming to the tune of billions. This is another shocker in the marketing side. Looks like a company called Webroot has been researching why adware doesn't go away. What's driving the continued pressure of adware? Because most people that use computers are aware of it, and they don't really pay attention to it. They ignore it. It's mostly just background noise. Apparently, the pure profit in the total adware market is estimated at $2.5 billion annually.
Wow.
$2.5 billion of people randomly clicking on stuff. That's just amazing to me, because I've never bought anything by seeing something pop up and saying, oh, that's a great deal, I'm going to click on it and go there and buy it.
But you're a geek.
Well, I guess, but other people must not feel the same way as I do. Have any of you guys?
No, I've never bought on stuff that it's spamware and such.
Never gone definitely and clicked not on it. All right. Well, this guy gathered 1.5 million machines, and he scanned them using this Webroot spy audit tool. And he found that there are some major prevalent pieces out there. And the shocking part is that half of the machines on the internet are infected with adware.
Mm-hmm.
And the amount of revenue that this even one company is making from it is enormous. It's amazing.
Wow.
So get your machines protected.
Quit clicking, you people. You're affecting the rest of us.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me are geeks Sean Cleveland and Drew Meyer. We were doing some geek news. Now we're going to get into solar energy. Our guest, Andy Black, is solar customer consultant. He's a buyer's assistant and solar financial analyst. He owns OnGrid Solar, OnGrid.net. Andy, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you very much for having me here.
It was very patient of you to sit through our geek news and chuckle away silently.
Fascinating.
All right. So you help people set up their homes for solar.
Right.
Your day job?
That's my day job.
Cool. Very cool. Now, you just started, and there's a lot of people out there pushing for solar, and most of them are sales reps for certain solar products. You're taking a different tact on that.
Right. I did that for 4 years with a couple of different companies over in the San Jose area, and one thing I liked about that was I got to spend a lot of time with customers educating and talking about it. One thing I didn't like about it was I had to represent that one company I was working for, and I liked the idea of being in the middle between the sellers and the buyer, so I can help the buyer make an informed decision amongst several sellers with my experience of, you know, having competed with and looked at this for quite a long time, so I can help them make a fair and accurate assessment of the differences between the offers, help them make, you know, compare them on an apples to apples basis, mm-hmm, and so mm-hmm on.
And is the whole setup of getting your house wired a pretty technically complicated process?
No, it's actually pretty simple. It's
for you, or simple for everybody?
Well, I mean, you do
hold an MS and EE degree, so it's kind of like you know what you're doing in electronics.
But it's actually still really quite simple. You put solar panels on the roof. You wire them down to a piece of electronics called an inverter. You wire that into your electric panel where the circuit breakers are.
Oh, that's a breeze. Okay, go on.
And that's it. You've got a couple of switches. Now, it's not something any homeowner can just do right off the bat, but you can take some fairly easy-to-understand classes to learn how to do it. To get by the inspector is a little bit more challenging because you need to know the right kind of wires and you need to do it up to code.
Right.
What about batteries?
Generally, I recommend people avoid batteries. Batteries are
messy,
popular,
dirty thing.
Messy, dirty, expensive.
Well, they're not required. People forget. You know, we're talking, this is grid-tied solar, right, Andy?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, right. So let's
talk about that.
How do you deal with not having batteries? I mean, how do you store the energy, for example?
Well, you store it inside the utility, essentially, but you don't store it as electricity because electricity can't be stored. You store it as financial credit with the utility. So you sell the electricity back to the utility, literally spinning your meter backwards and counting down your electric.
And this is legal and okay?
It's legal under the net metering law in California.
Okay, right? And I'm assuming that means that you're not putting in any, you're using energy from the grid at night and you're putting energy into the grid during sunny days.
You sell when you have sun and you're not using it in your own home or business.
How close are the margins for a homeowner in having solar? Are you like stressed when there's cloudy days?
No, because you're using the utility anytime you need it, so the utility is there as if
Financially stressed. I mean, the idea is that you put a large outlay of cash to get your house hooked up, and then the assumption is that over time you'll get enough money going back in that you'll have saved money over a... What's the duration of time for payback on the system?
Ah, so typical paybacks... I actually don't use payback as a metric for evaluating them on residential systems, because it's hard to use payback. Payback doesn't value the amount of savings you're going to have after payback has been achieved.
Okay.
I use internal rate of return, which is the same as looking for an interest rate on the investment. I use cash flow, so if you borrow the money to pay for the solar system, are you ahead financially or behind?
Well, let's say we borrow. How much? First off, a family of five, that's a big, you know, relatively big family, a little bit above average family of five. What do they need to get their house... how much energy do they want to be generating to kind of pay off their electrical bill at a certain time?
Well, it all depends on how much they use and how extravagant their lifestyle is or how careful their lifestyle is.
Well, let's say they're like an average person watching TV 9 hours a day and
right.
and doing a lot of laundry and stuff. And what are the and let's say they're doing like a forced air heater that's electrical.
Right.
I mean, how do you figure out, first off, how much energy you're using? Is that one of the first stages in determining if your house is going to be...
Right. You want to look at your electric bill. The first thing you do is look at your electric bill and figure out how many kilowatt hours you're using.
All right.
And that's the data that I take and put into my spreadsheet. So an average home in California uses about $75 a month worth of electricity.
Which is how many kilowatt hours?
It depends on the area, because it depends on your baseline, which gets real complicated. We don't need to go there.
Okay.
But it's approximately 500 to 600 kilowatt hours a month. So
500 to 600 kilowatt hours a month is about $75 a month from PG&E today?
In PG&E territory, in, you know, sort of your average areas, yes.
Roughly. Okay, right. So $75 a month. And what's it going to take, roughly, to supply that amount of energy with a solar installation?
Averaged over a year.
Average. I mean, this is all general, right? We're not going to hold you to
right.
this.
Right. So we...
Pops open his laptop.
Well, I want to make sure I can quote my numbers from the paper I put on my website, so that I normally refer people to that article rather than just trying to wing it here.
Does that mean you need solar panels that produce 500 to 600 kilowatts?
No, actually you don't, because you can take advantage of the net metering laws and the time of use tariffs, which means you can sell electricity back to the utility at a high rate during the day.
Because day rates are more expensive than night rates.
You can elect to go onto a rate which has the day rates are more expensive.
You know, I'm curious about that. The PG&E sets up this rate structure because more energy is used during the day, mostly because of businesses running and air conditioning running during the day and not running at night. But I'm wondering, in different, if you broke up the grid more, you know, chopped it up smaller and looked at just homes in a certain area, those homes during the day aren't going to be using very much energy because people are not there.
That's right. So, your question?
Yeah, so that those homes produce.
Yeah, a solar home in an area would produce, and you would have, if you had a lot of solar homes, that neighborhood would
have
send
a benefit.
Power back to the major grid.
Okay. But PG&E is not going to change their rate structure and say, you know, in this neighborhood, we're going to charge more at night because it's a home
residence. I'm sure they will.
Will they do that kind of separation, or is it too hard technically for them to do that?
They've divided California into approximately 10 or 12 territories. So, for example, San Jose, where I live, is called Territory X, and it's a large area. You know, it's probably 100 square miles of geography. Other territories are even larger. So they say, well, Territory X is defined by a certain geographic region up to a certain altitude. So homes above that altitude might have different heating and cooling requirements. So
okay.
That's why they have an altitude function in
there. All right, you got your numbers out in front of you now.
Mm-hmm.
If you got, like, let's say a 500 kilowatt usage mm-hmm. in your home, what kind of system are you going to need? Let's talk about the Central Coast. We got some fog in the mornings, but most of the time we got some sunny days.
About a 3 kilowatt system would do it.
Well, and that's much smaller than the 500 to 600 watt. So,
yes.
How many panels? How many square footage is that on your roof?
About 300 square feet.
300 square feet. Is that an average home size?
Well, most homes are, let's say, 1,400 square feet. So, on each side of the roof, they'd have 700 square feet. You'd only be using less than half of that for solar panels.
Not bad, really.
Oh, many homes have plenty of room to put what they need on the roof, yeah.
What do you see as the greatest benefit of solar energy in the home? Do you see it as a lessening of personal bills, or do you see it as a social thing?
I think it depends on who you ask, right?
Well, yeah. I'm asking this guy, so yeah. Andy.
Well, Andy's got opinions, I'm sure.
People, well, I've found after 4 years of directly interfacing with customers, people do it for four major reasons.
Hmm.
The original and oldest reason is probably the environmental side, but coupled with that is independence, and that gets back to in the old days, people did have to use batteries with their solar systems. People now do solar for independence, but more to be independent of PG&E psychologically, or on a financial side, independent of rate hikes in the future. So they, you know, once you do solar, your electricity could be as little as $5 a month, and it'll pretty much stay that way until you either change your usage or get rid of the solar system.
What about going to a situation where you've got a lot more solar panels? You talk about 300 square feet of solar panels for that 500 to 600 kilowatt. What about tripling that and just making money from PG&E?
Unfortunately, the net metering law does not allow you to sell electricity back and get paid for it.
So it just reduces your costs.
You can bring your bill down to zero on an annual basis, but you can't ever get a check from PG&E, or they're not obligated to send you a check.
And therefore they won't, right?
And they don't, yeah.
Mm. So they could be getting a lot more energy than you're using.
They could be if you had an improperly sized system, right? It's if you size it properly, you want to bring it out so that you end up spending about $5 a month.
Do you have to pitch your solar panels? And solar panels don't move that I see, but do you have to change the pitch during certain seasons?
You can, and you can get a little bit more energy out of them that way. Generally, it's not cost effective or in some senses practical. Most people have enough trouble remembering to just look at the inverter to make sure the system is still working, much less taking the effort to go up on the roof and change the slope.
Drew, you helped set this show up, so do you have any questions for Andy?
We were talking about the payback, or the term, you know, that's not one term that you like to use, but how do you measure the return on the investment, the internal rate of return, et cetera? So if we spend X dollars on a 3-kilowatt system, how long will it take before that actually is worth money or makes money for me? If I'm a financially incented kind of guy.
Right. There's actually three ways I like to look at the return on investment. One is the internal rate of return, which is looking at the interest rate. And the way you do that is you set up a 25-year financial timeline. Look at the expenditures from the solar system. So what did you pay for the system? Roll in the tax benefits, because there's a tax credit available. If you're commercial, there's also depreciation available and a second tax credit. Then you want to look at the savings each year over 25 years, and you want to remember to factor in inflation, because electricity is probably going to get more expensive.
Okay.
You want to factor in maintenance. You want to remember that the inverter is probably not going to last 25 years, so you put in an inverter replacement cost. I insert it around year 15. Then add each of the 25 years' annual numbers up to create a timeline of net cash flow for that year. A big outlay in the first year, savings and tax benefits.
And see if that's better than what the interest you can get on the first original loan.
Not comparing it to a loan. You just apply the internal rate of return tool, which is available. It's a form of financial analysis.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives you the equivalent interest rate you're going to earn back from this varying stream of cash payments.
Okay.
So you do all that.
I love that. You know, I started with one of the first questions, how complicated is this? And you're like, it's a breeze, no problem. And sure, when you talk about kilowatt hours, and you talk about inverters and, you know, DC to AC and all that, yeah, for me, no problem. I understand that completely. But that math stuff, woo, geeky.
Well, that's why I do it with a spreadsheet.
Okay, that's,
yeah.
That's good.
So
yeah.
I don't.
So
have
you
to
can
repeat.
Give me an Excel sheet that I can look at.
Give you an Excel spreadsheet,
plug in
print out. You can take it to your CPA and have them review it and analyze it. The bottom line is the interest rates are typically between 9% and 13% for a homeowner.
Now so you're a third party person here. You're kind of helping right. The consumer.
That's
which
right.
Is yes. New. This is kind of interesting.
I believe it's unique. Yes.
People yeah. Definitely need someone like you to help them with this sort of a thing, because it's not something you can just sit down and figure out on your own.
Well,
without a lot of research.
Not totally true. I mean, the old model, which is still going to thrive, is you hire, or you don't hire, but you have several salesmen come out.
That's the thing, that they're salesmen.
Right.
They want to sell you something.
You're going to get a biased pitch, but by asking them lots of questions, you can, a careful person can get a pretty good sense of what's going on. I simplify that process. That's what I'm all about, is making it easier, saving the homeowner time, and making the whole process more efficient. So I can probably provide more insights than you're going to get from three different salesmen, but, you know, that's that's up to the customers to choose how they want to handle it. So,
right.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. It's time now to call in with questions and comments. Please, let's stay on topic today, solar energy. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
Bring your mom to the Seymour Center at Long Marine Lab on Mother's Day, Sunday, May 8th, for the Marvelous Marine Mammal Moms. The tour will showcase marine mammal moms and the strategies they use to raise their young successfully. The Seymour Center is on the west side of Santa Cruz. Call 459-3800 or check seymourcenter.ucsc.edu for more information.
Mubarak. He was a sissy. And it turned his family into a Greek tragedy. Kind of like Oedipus. Dad vanished. Mubarak was left with his mom, caring for her like a husband might.
All right, lift your breast. Lift one at a time so I can wash under it.
Okay.
Sissies, and why they are so feared. This week on This American Life from Public Radio International.
This is Central Coast Public Radio KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland and Drew Meyer. We're speaking with Andy Black about solar energy. You're welcome to join our conversations. The phone number is 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org to send us email. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL. Now with nationwide access, information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruiseio.com or by calling 459-6301. We're talking about solar energy. You're welcome to join our conversation. Phone number is 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can send us email through geekspeak.org. Andy, we were just talking about kind of the technology to some degree. I want to get some details about what you prefer. And when the solar energy field kind of first arose, we've done a couple shows on this subject for Geek Speak over the 7 years we've been doing the show. And when the show first, when this field first emerged, you kind of bought the thing you could get. It was kind of hard to find stuff. But now we're seeing a lot of products on the market, a lot of solar panels, a lot of inverters. So what are some of the brand names you recommend for solar panels, for example?
Sure. In solar panels, I am very comfortable with any of the major manufacturers. For example, Sharp is number one in the world. Kyocera is number two. Sanyo makes a great module. So does BP, Shell. They're all, there's a whole number of them. Those are big companies, well-backed, going to be around for a long time in my estimation. So they're going to be around to handle the 25-year warranty that comes with each solar panel. Now, there's smaller companies like Evergreen, Unisolar, First Solar, and so on. They're smaller companies, not quite as stable, but they're American-grown technology. So if you want to support that or support the new innovative type of thing, that's another way to go. They also put long warranties on their products, but there's always a risk with smaller companies. They may not be around quite as long.
That warranty won't necessarily work if they don't exist anymore, right?
Yeah. And the inverter side, I should mention SunPower also is a new company in the solar panel world, but it's backed by Cypress Semiconductor, which is a major Silicon Valley company, and they have an intent of being major players in the solar industry. So I suspect they'll be around for a long time, but they're new. So I know their engineers. I think they're going to do a very good job, and so I'm comfortable recommending that panel as well.
From a sunny place in California, Salinas, Maureen, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I have a question about I receive four bills from PG&E every month, one for my house and three sort of ag bills.
Mm-hmm. What do the ad bills run? Like a well and such?
Right, right. Okay. Wells and pumps.
Okay.
And would you be limited? I mean, would I be able to use, if I were to, install solar, a fairly large amount, would I be able to use it towards all four bills, or would they limit you, to maybe your home bill?
In some ways, you have an advantage because you could put in four different solar systems, one on each meter, each bill, each bill is a result of a different meter on your property.
Wouldn't that mean that she'd have to get four inverters? I mean, that seems like a larger outlay.
Well, most inverters are between 3 and 6 kilowatts. So chances are she would fill up the capacity of an inverter on each one of those anyway. She might need multiple inverters for each bill. It depends on the size of the bills, the amount of energy used.
We don't know how much are your bills running right now?
Probably right around $200 a month for all four combined.
All four combined. So an analysis would, you know, take into account the different ones. You'd really have to look at each one as a different system, though, because you can only feed back
as much as you use.
Right. You can only zero out each bill, and you can't take from
she
one and serve the other.
PG&E doesn't think of her as one person with multiple meters. So they think of her as four customers.
Because
I know that one of the things you should do when you get a system like this is you want to change your bill to be an annual bill so that your bill is averaged throughout the entire year.
That's going to be automatic with the net metering.
Okay.
You choose the e-net rate schedule.
But the idea of combining different meters is not something you can do.
You could do that.
Why does she have to use 4 meters?
Yeah, why do you have to use 4 meters? You got a big piece of property?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there's one, you know, like I said, one goes to the house, one's to the residence, and then others are spread out.
For different pumps or other activity, right?
Right.
Right. So each one would get separately assessed. Now, you could certainly enjoy some savings from whoever your installer was because they could do it as one job. From a cost point of view, they would go down and possibly even pull one permit, although they might need to pull 4 permits for rebate purposes. In fact, I think they would. But from their cost point of view, they're on site to do one large installation that happened to be spread over 4 things. Or they may determine that it doesn't make any sense to do 1 or 2 of them.
If they're really small amounts of electricity.
Small, yeah, it may not just be practical.
Are there small systems that can handle a real, you know, trickle load that would compensate for a pump, for example?
Not very easily, no.
Okay.
Yeah, it's you don't look at it as a trickle thing.
Because you're also dealing with a situation, if it's a pump, you know, assuming there's a pump house, you're not going to have a lot of real estate on that roof of that pump house, if you even have some of these locations, even have space of that nature. So you'd have to be building some kind of structure and making sure that you've got some sunlight at that location.
Right, yeah, exactly. And certainly you could do a ground
mount. Is this a challenge you'd be interested in looking at?
I certainly could.
All right.
You could put a panel on a pole, though, couldn't you?
Yeah.
Kind of like the state does with these telephones.
Yeah, ground mount is.
And those
going
to be big enough to manage a high flow?
Well, we don't know enough about the situation.
Right,
I mean,
of course.
She wants it to be grid tied because she runs her pump at
Maureen,
night.
It looks like separate installations for each meter.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you for
question.
The call.
Might really benefit
bye-bye.
You.
All right. From Monterey, we've got Kelly. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi. I have a question, just a couple questions. One is, I have I live in Carmel Valley, actually, and up in the mountains. And at the house, I've got a rather nice rate for off-peak because we have an electric vehicle that we charge. And while that may not last, you know, forever, nonetheless, I would really like the idea of solar and would like to do it. The question is, these extra charges that you, if you actually look at a PG&E bill, the amount it appears that you actually pay for the electricity that you use seems to be about 2/3 of the bill, while the rest are a bunch of these extraordinary charges that just...
administrative sort of.
Exactly.
That make your
excises
that make your back tense up and
exactly
and your brow furrow.
Yeah. Some money for Nevada.
You don't like paying for nuclear decommissioning?
That's exactly right. Or cleanup.
Yeah.
But I wonder if those charges either go away or are minimized when you grid tie a system or sell electricity back to the system.
Absolutely. They're all proportional to the number of kilowatt hours you use. So if you reduce your usage, those charges go down as well.
Wow.
Nice. Excellent.
Stick it to the man.
Now, I'd like to actually do this. So what's the best route to do this?
Well, I think the best step probably is to go ahead and go to geekspeak.org. You'll see a link for today's show. From there, you'll be able to link off to Andy's site and be able to talk to him. He's got his phone numbers and stuff on there.
Thank
Does that
so
work
much.
For you, Andy?
That's fine. I can also suggest you can go to this California Energy Commission website, consumerenergycenter.com, I believe, or .org,
okay.
And there's a list of contractors that would serve your area.
And just go right to a contractor?
Yeah, that's another way to do it. If you want to get individual bids, you could do that, or you can link to me and email me.
Okay, grand. Thank you so much for your help.
Thank you, Maureen, for the call.
Yeah, bye-bye.
You're welcome to join the You're in the conversation. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. From Capitola, Miguel, welcome to Geek Speak.
I'm calling to say that Andy Black's, what he's talking about is actually working. I have a friend in Aptos who every day sees his meters rolling backwards. Even though he has a family of four, his solar is producing a good deal more electricity and at the peak rates than they consume.
Well, that's a relief.
Fantastic.
Great, Miguel.
We'd hate to hear you say otherwise, Miguel.
Thanks for the input. Yeah.
I wish I had details on what he's doing.
Yeah, and how much what a system he has and such, but you do see it working.
And he's got lots of electronics. They don't live all that frugally.
Uh-huh.
And all he doesn't know yet, I guess he hasn't looked up, is will he eventually lose, like losing minutes on a cell phone? Will PG eventually take away all the surplus that he's building up? Or will he have to open up an aluminum smelting factory to burn all of those credits?
Well, thank you, Miguel, for the call. We're going to go ahead and answer that offline. Thanks.
Yeah. Turns out that on an annual basis, you can zero out your bill. If you end up with credits at the end of the year, you do lose them.
Okay, but what about if PG&E decides to change their model?
So that's a common question. They're regulated by the California Public Utilities Commission. And the Public Utilities Commission answers, in theory, to the public and the legislature to some extent.
Perfect. No problem there.
Well, so they could. I mean, they can do anything. They can change the rates. They can change the rate schedules. They could do all sorts of stuff. What they typically have done in the past is they'll close a rate schedule, for example, the time of use net metering rate schedule. They might close it to new customers. So those who didn't get in on time might not be able to. But those who are already in typically are grandfathered. Now, they don't have to do that, but they could,
right?
And they likely will.
So the sooner the better?
Well, to some extent, the sooner the better. The other thing to keep in mind is when the Public Utilities Commission was contemplating a 0.5 cent tax on solar, it got referred to as the solar tax. It was actually the departing load charge of a couple of years ago. They got so much email that it shut down their servers twice in a week of public outcry and protest against the concept of any kind of hindrance to solar progression and development.
Nice.
So if they were to do something this large, they would get lawsuits. It'd be a massive.
It'd be a mess. So you're pretty much safe.
I'm not at all worried. Yeah.
All right. From Carmel, Ruth, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hello.
Hello, Ruth.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say thanks so much for putting on this program. I think it's terrific because with peak oil coming supposedly in the next 5 to 10 years, solar energy is going to be probably really important. But the question I had was, for that average person that was using, I think it was 500 kilowatt hours a month, or I don't know, whatever your average was, how much would the initial cost be? Because I think I can convince my husband of it, but I need to first tell him kind of approximately how much a system would cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, is it $5,000 or $50,000? Just a general kind of ballpark range for an average system.
Sure. For a 3-kilowatt system, ballpark, you can... The top line cost is going to be around $27,000 or $28,000, but the state will pay for part of that system, approximately a third of it. So you're talking between that and the tax credit, it's going to cost you everything included, permits usually, except some towns are expensive, around $17,000 or $18,000. Now that's Silicon Valley prices, and those tend to be a little higher than other areas, so you might even get it for a little cheaper than that for a 3-kilowatt CEC rated system.
So for around $20,000 or under, you could get a system that would probably make your bills be zero at the end of the year.
If you're an average $70 to $80 a month customer, certainly. Yeah.
What was that figure again?
That's upfront, $20,000 roughly. Right.
And that's your once you pay, all the bills for the project, the permit fee and all that stuff and the contractor's costs, and after you collect the rebate and do your taxes, that's what a typical homeowner will cost.
Do you see this as something that, because of peak oil coming up, is going to be a big wave of the future? Or?
I think it's going to be a big wave for other reasons than peak oil. Oil is not very commonly used to generate electricity in this country. Natural gas is, but those are somewhat decoupled. So, but there's going to be lots of other reasons why I think solar is going to become very popular. Kyoto Protocol, it's enormous in Europe and Japan,
and I think we're just falling behind. But we, you know, California's electorate and public are extremely interested in solar. The governor is very interested in solar. In fact, there's a bill called Senate Bill 1, which is a very favorable bill for the development of solar energy.
Ruth, thank you for the call, and good luck on convincing your husband.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
We have some more calls on hold, and we're going to get to them in just a second. And the phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Question, Andy. Do you see... I mean, I hear a lot about side effects about solar panels. For example, these solar panels have to be created. The process for making them is chemically enhanced and chemically complicated. There's byproducts for making the solar panels. There's a lot of cost outlay if you think of the industry and the electricity put into making the solar panel. Mm-hmm. You don't see that from an electrical cost, but you see that from a price of buying these things. What do you think about the social ramifications of creating an industry that does a lot of chemical byproducts, a lot of power usage and everything to produce these panels that then will, you know, allow you to make a cheaper electrical rates over a long period of time?
Certainly. Well, the industry is just like the semiconductor industry in that it uses a lot of energy and has a lot of toxic materials associated with it. The OSHA and EPA requirements require those things to be entirely contained within the plant, so the actual releases from plants is extremely small, if any at all. So everything is recycled and recaptured. From an energy point of view, it does take about three and a half years of output from the panels to give back the energy that it took to make them, and that's all of the energy.
How many years?
3 to 3.5 years, depending on the technology. Some are actually much closer to 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
But then I'm talking the aluminum frames, the glass on the front, the silicon wafers in them, the inverter, the wiring, all of that energy combined. It takes about 3 years to give back the energy it took to make all that system.
That's a cool figure.
They'll likely last for how many years?
Well, they're warranted to last and put out at least 80% of their rated output for 25 years. So if they're putting out over 80% at 25 years, my bet is they're going to last 40 to 50 years. The first panel ever installed commercially was installed in Georgia. It's still putting out measurable power over 50 years ago.
Very cool. Okay, cool. I want to take some more calls. We do have some people, but I've got one more question for you regarding the pollutants, if you will, that you're responsible for right now in this area using electricity. We get our electricity in the Central Coast from coal and from nuclear energy. Nuclear energy arguably has a very small amount of output, if you will, of bad stuff, but it's really hard to deal with. But coal has a lot of output, a lot of emissions, and we're all using it right now. So
waste.
So yeah. From a social perspective, the output of doing that means that the grid itself is using less coal. Is that correct?
Right. Every kilowatt hour that a solar system puts onto the grid means that that little bit less coal needs to be burned, and therefore that much less going up the stack.
Very cool. Okay.
These panels, what's the upkeep? Do you actually have to get on your roof and clean them every now and then?
I recommend, if possible, that they be installed in a way that you can literally just spray them off from the ground. I don't think it's a great idea for people to be climbing on the roofs. It wears out the roof, but it also is a little bit dangerous.
Yeah.
So if you can turn your garden hose on them and literally just rinse them down.
How often do you do that?
Well, it depends on how dusty and dry the area is.
Okay.
If the winter rains will take care of it, but if you got a lot of dusting, if you're near an agricultural area or a road, you might need to do it 3 or 4 times in the summer, maybe more often right after harvest, for example, in agricultural areas. Other people might only have to do it once or twice, just literally spray them down. If you don't do it at all, you might lose another 5% of your performance.
Now, how tough are they? If you have big trees nearby or you're in the mountains, in the redwoods, you do have to worry about them breaking if a branch hits them?
If a big branch hits them, yeah, it probably could smash them. They're tested by the National Renewable Energy Laboratory to withstand a 1-inch hail ball at 60 miles an hour. So they're designed for hail environments.
It's like a golf ball, isn't it?
It's like a golf ball at 60 miles an hour, and it hails pretty hard. It'll mess up a car, but it can withstand the impact.
Okay, we got a lot of calls coming in, so let's go ahead and go to Big Sur. Richard, welcome to Geek Speak.
Howdy, I'm calling from Big Sur, and I've lived off-grid for 14 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I have a couple of comments more than any questions.
Mm-hmm.
To address what's the maintenance of it, one catchphrase that I use, it's lower maintenance than a cat. And I have a battery back. I have a battery-based system.
Now, are you solar or wind or combination?
I am solar combined with micro-hydroelectric. I have steep land with a seasonal creek that runs through.
How much power do you get out of micro-hydroelectric?
As much as I need. I size the nozzles to my draw, uh-huh. Just so I don't you know, put a, I have a dump load into a water heating system. I have all that I need. Even in the El Nino years, when PG&E was blown off the face of the earth here, all my friends and neighbors were coming to my house to do a wash, because my system has never gone down since I turned it on.
All right, and you say that the maintenance on this, and you've got a relatively complicated system, the maintenance on it is less than a cat.
Absolutely.
Because you don't have to feed it every day, for example.
Not even.
And no vet visits, though there are some drawbacks. So you also have a suggestion, I hear, for one of our callers. Is that true?
Well, yeah. Call? Anybody that's in the Salinas Valley, you know, there's more than one way to make the electricity. What we're talking about here mostly is solar panels, but there are also wind turbines. Why we do not have a massive amount of wind turbines up and down the Salinas Valley, gee, I can't figure that one.
Because
there's
wind
all over,
yeah,
and that's 24/7, you know, especially this time of year.
Well, that's definitely something that that our caller, I think, Maureen, could do with the 4 PG&E bill. She's in the Salinas
Valley. Absolutely.
If she's got wind, that might be the way to go.
Yeah.
Anybody in Salinas Valley or any place where it's windy, go stick a turbine up in the air. They're cheap. It's a lot cheaper than solar panels, and it works all the same way.
Like the Altamont Pass has them all over the place.
Absolutely. And there's even small ones, too, where the body of it's the size of a bread box. And, you know, they can all be quite compact, the size of your use.
I thought those were fans, you know. They were creating the wind over San Joaquin Valley. But they're actually...
Yeah, right.
Oh, come on.
Richard, are you using 110 AC?
Fully AC.
Okay.
It's an inverter system.
So you don't have to worry about trying to buy appliances and stuff. It's not a problem.
No. I buy whatever's off the shelf. I made that decision long ago. It was funny. I built the system before we built the house, and these swaggering, strutting construction workers are going, oh, solar system, it'll never run my big old beam saws. And I say, it's been happening for the last 4 days and nothing's sagged yet, so keep going.
Nice. Great, Richard, thank you very much for the call.
So, Andrew, how clean is this power? You know, we hear about power spikes from, you know, from PG&E, you know, frying electronic equipment. I'm worried about that. What's it like from solar?
You need to be more worried about PG&E's power than you do about solar power.
I figured.
It's required to meet total harmonic distortion, or essentially noise requirements, well within what PG&E's supposed to be able to supply, but because of complications in their system, it's not always possible. I mean, they have a difficult job.
Right.
I want to get more calls in. So from Big Sur, Harmony, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi, good morning. I think you answered the first half of my question about the energy it takes to produce a panel.
Mm-hmm.
Are there some companies that are more efficient at this than others?
Sure. Evergreen Solar and any of the thin film companies. I'm actually presenting a paper this summer on that subject. Thin films take a lot less energy because they use a lot less materials to manufacture. So
are they as efficient at solar conversion to electricity?
Generally, they're not as efficient, so it takes more area. It doesn't necessarily cost you more because you buy them based on kilowatts, not on area or number of panels. So Unisolar, First Solar, Iowa Thin Films, Global Solar Energy, some of those are not yet available on the market.
Okay, so you recommend, if you're really concerned about the energy to create these things, you're recommending thin film solars.
Thin films and Evergreen has a different type of silicon processing
Evergreen.
That uses about two-thirds of the energy.
Now, is Evergreen one of these small companies that you'd be concerned about the warranty because they might not be around?
All of these are small companies.
Okay.
How
does your home insurance deal with, let's say, a hailstorm and a panel getting destroyed? Are you going to see recovery for that or not?
If you inform your insurance company and they'll include it on your policy, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, and it's a pretty rare event, so it's not going to probably increase your policy very much.
Around here, it's quite rare, yeah.
A
branch is more likely, and you want to make sure your trees are not shading the system.
Harmony, thank you for the call.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. I love getting people calling in from Big Sur, because we are the radio station in Big Sur, and so it's always nice to see devoted people calling up. And thanks, Big Sur, for participating. Okay, from Santa Cruz, a little closer, Solar Mike. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there, geeks. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, Mike.
Hey. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Mike. Good talking to you.
Hey, Drew. I didn't know if you were regularly on this show, but I just wanted to find out how your solar electric system's doing. Have you had a chance to talk about it? And you know, what's your experience?
Did Mike install it for you, Drew?
Mike, as a matter of fact, did hook me up, you could say, with the solar system, and it's been fantastic. One of the reasons that I'm excited about this topic is because I actually own a solar system myself on our house. I live in a 1,900 square foot house. Sorry, about between 900 and 1,000 square feet. Small Santa Cruz bungalow type place. Has about 300 square feet worth of wattage on the roof. I think that's right, Mike. That's what I remember.
That's about right. Yeah.
And it's a 2.1 kilowatt system. and it's been running the meter backwards since we turned it on at the end of last summer. All through the winter, it's been running just bomb-proof, and I get a big grin on my face when I walk out there in the morning and see the meter running backwards.
And how are your bills?
Less than $5 last month.
Nice.
Yep, all through the winter, all through the coldest part of the year when we were running more lights, it was darker. We ran electric heaters occasionally. I used to get on my wife's case about that. Now I'm like, turn it on, honey, warm it up, bring it on. Come on, suck that energy down.
So what did you pay for something like that?
So we paid about $20,000 up front, but the rebates brought it down because this is a little smaller system than we were just talking about. So after the taxes last year, we were into it for about $11,000 or $12,000.
Okay.
And I expect that to be paid off in 13, 14 years using traditional payoff methods.
Yeah.
So I guess what I can share with listeners out there, for me, this was a large part emotional decision. I really believe in the technology, and I'm geeky enough to enjoy it. And like I said, I'll go out there with a beer on Saturday night and just get a big smile looking at the meter. Not a lot of people look
during
at their
the day,
meters.
Right?
Yeah. And there's a little bit of economic and financial incentive, but not so much as taking a stand, you know, being political.
It's just like hybrid cars.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to believe in, you know, you're saving energy and, well, gas emissions.
Right. Mike, your installation of these systems in Santa Cruz, go ahead and give us contact information for you since you called in.
Well, that was nice. Thanks. Well, I work with Eco Energies and Solar Mike. My phone number is 831-427-9070. And I want to thank you guys for bringing the solar message out to Santa Cruz on Earth Day.
Yeah, pretty applicable. I forgot about that last
great
week.
Great timing.
Yeah.
And great weather for it, too.
Thank you, Mike, for the call.
All right, thanks for the show. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye. I forgot about Earth Day. Google's got a new picture for that.
That's
how I saw it this morning.
That's how I learned about holidays, actually.
Yeah.
And just a little bit of disclosure here. Yes. I used to work for Solar Mike at Eco Energies.
Okay, well, that's good to know.
And I think very highly of them. So.
Oh, good. Thanks.
And we actually did get, got one more call from Rob. We're not going to be able to take any more calls after this. So, Rob, welcome to Geek Speak. La Selva Beach. Rob, there?
Hello.
Hi, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I live in La Selva, and it tends to be a bit foggier than Santa Cruz, and I wanted to know how well a solar system would work there.
Yeah, how do you determine if you're in the right environment?
Right. There is variations, obviously, with microclimates. It would be good to determine how much cloudier it is, but typically the variation between San Jose and Santa Cruz is only about 5%. And it, again, depends on the part of Santa Cruz we're talking about.
Is there a way that you can find this out, you know, even by doing some test of some kind?
The most straightforward way is to put a little pyranometer, which is a solar measuring device, to evaluate it. There are low-cost and medium-cost ones as well as expensive.
Okay, how does Rob figure this out? How did he get one of these devices, and how does he keep track to figure out what is...
The way I've done it before was when I was at Eco Energies, I had one of their engineers install a little tracking device, a measuring device, so you could call Solar Mike and ask to get that, or you know, perhaps I could help you with that. That's probably the most straightforward.
I guess the other thing to do, depending on how friendly you are with neighbors, you could drive around until you find some of the solar panels and go, hey, how's it working for you?
That's another option.
That's a way to go.
Generally, people are pretty willing to talk about
it. Oh, yeah, definitely.
They're pretty cool.
Rob, I hope that answers your question.
Sounds pretty good. Pyranometer.
Yeah, there's other little devices as well, but
there you go.
Give Solar Mike a call.
good luck. Eco Energies?
Eco Energies, yeah. Or me, I can help you hook up with
all
that.
Right. So you can find out Andy's contact information from our website. All right, we are wrapping up towards the end of the show. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Our guest, Andy Black, is a solar consumer consultant, buyer's assistant, and solar financial analyst. He can figure out all the math for you. He is also owner of OnGrid Solar. You can get to that by ongrid.net. You can also call him at... You okay with this?
Sure.
All right. 408-428-0808. And, of course, he's Andy at ongrid.net. Andy happens to have an MS degree, a BS in electrical engineering, and an MSEE. So he knows his electronics quite well. He's a board member of the board of directors of the American Solar Energy Society and serves as chapter's representative for this area. Andy, thank you very much for being on GeekSpeak today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, all you geeks out there, if you run a lot of servers and your air conditioning bill is high and your electrical usage is high, Run them for free with a solar system. That's one of the things I got a kick out of this. I don't feel guilty about running my computer all night long anymore.
You don't?
Not a bit.
Oh, that's good.
And I crunch numbers for whatever I want. To sit there and let it run. Heat the room. It doesn't matter. It's all from the sun. All right, I've gotten excited enough. We probably should wrap up the show. Huh?
Next week, we've got Nigel McFarlane, author of Firefox Hacks. We'll be talking about the browser Firefox.
Oh, great.
That book's on O'Reilly. The Geeks This Morning, John Trey. So wait. Sean Cleveland and Drew Meyer. Our guest is Andy Black. You can learn more information about him by going to geekspeak.org. To those that called in, thank you very much for making GeekSpeak what it is. Without you, it would just be us geeking out, and who wants to listen to that? Coming up next is Open Road at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KDBH, San Otter, or on the web at kusp.org. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. A British judge has sentenced an accomplice of Richard Reed, the infamous shoe bomber.